press that we stand ready to acquire portfolios of privately owned property that are market affordable, including Joe Weston's portfolio. He has a plan to divest his remaining 2,500, 2,700 units to other owners, and he's made it clear that he will transfer those assets first to the Joe Weston Foundation, and which will then sell them. So we have an intention of bulk purchase where investor owners are interested in maintaining long-term affordability. We need a willing seller, however, for this effort to work. We're not in a position of inserting ourselves into a situation unless the seller really has an interest in preserving the affordability.
Yeah. Kurt, a couple of weeks ago, I asked Mark a question of how many people who are homeless because they had a home, but then their rents went up and they couldn't afford it. And Mark said that didn't have a precise number, would look into it. I think it would be helpful, I mean, to the extent that we can get that data, to get that information, plus information on the percentage of homelessness that's caused by other factors. Like, is it 22% are people who had homes last year, but the rents went up and they couldn't afford it, and 17% are people who were in an affordable unit that was knocked down or replaced by more expensive housing, and 22% people who had a mental health breakdown, and that's why on the street. I mean, I think that I realize it might be hard to be precise, but I think for one thing, it'd be good for us as decision makers to know, but also as we hear from people in the community talking about the homelessness crisis, people have their own theories, and it'd be nice to have more data to respond to them.
We'll be happy to respond in writing. I would say also that this late spring, you'll receive the Fair Housing Plan for Multnomah County, for which the Housing Bureau is charged to develop. We've been very closely looking at mass evictions to try to demonstrate whether or not there's a disparate impact on people of color and people with disabilities through the no-cause eviction standard that is available to owners under Oregon state law. And if there is indeed a disparate impact, I think there could be a fair housing cause of action, which I think deserves close ongoing scrutiny.
I have a couple of questions also, and if you want to get back in writing, that's fine with me. To Steve's comment, I think in the document you presented, 63% of homeless are economically homeless, which I guess would mean you lost your job, the rent went up, you made some bad decisions, whatever. Is there a process within the city if I'm told my rent's going to go up or if I lose my job, I can pick up the phone and call somebody for help? I'm not sure it should be in the Housing Bureau. That's a general question. Back to Commissioner Fritz, if we could help before they become homeless, it seems to me an easier solution than trying to deal with it. I don't know.
I'd be happy to respond in writing. I think a written response is going to be helpful. But the short answer is yes. The council has appropriated short-term rental assistance funds, and some of that is for stabilization of people in place. So if there is a short-term economic issue that can be resolved, it's much less costly to keep someone in tenancy in their current unit to help bridge their affordability. however, there's a structural problem. Somebody's lost their job and they can't cover the rent. Obviously, that's a longer-term and more costly proposition.
Okay. Thank you. Is it possible to quantify the impact of the growth boundary decisions years ago on the affordability of housing in Portland?
Well, I think you could probably study it. I'm not sure that there's a smoking gun. I think a casual sort of action, looking back 40 years on the creation of the urban growth boundary would be challenging. This issue came up quite a lot in the legislature because many rural legislators wanted to bargain urban growth boundary expansions in their communities, Coos Creek County, Deschutes County, Klamath, and places like Ontario, for example. Our basic view is that we are so far inside the urban growth boundary that an expansion on the fringe in Damascus, South Cooper Mountain, Bethany Road has absolutely no effect whatsoever on housing demand in the city of Portland. That's my, I'm a happy honorary member of the Land Economics Society, Lambda Alpha. I think you could probably spend a lot of time in an academic environment trying to disaggregate the cost drivers, but in reality, I don't think it's had a serious effect on housing affordability in Portland.
Okay. I was interested in that resolution that you just shared with us. I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly...
The no net loss?
Was not aware of it, and probably didn't even live here when it was passed. But a broader question, there was an article in the Oregonian months ago about some agreement that was made in the Pearl with developers, with affordable housing. Affordable housing wasn't built. Nobody in the city monitored it. All of a sudden, we didn't have the affordable housing. And I'm not interested in going back and pointing fingers. What struck me was that there wasn't a process for monitoring an agreement. And this resolution tends to point out the same problem. We knew what we wanted, we lost it, and we didn't know that we had lost it till we had already lost it. Nobody was monitoring it. Is there a process in place now where if agreements are made, that actually somebody is going to be responsible for monitoring that?
Indeed, there is. And the state of housing that I described was published October of 2015. That's an annual report. And it reports on the status of compliance with every one of the plans for each urban renewal area. This was that particular property was in the River District. And there was a development agreement that was stipulated performance. So the state of housing is the repository for all that. And as I look at the upcoming state of housing, we're doing a deeper dive into the loss of affordable units through the short-term rental market because of this Airbnb sharing economy effect on rental housing stock. So it's not a static document. It's meant to be a dynamic document. But it does benchmark performance against each of the enacted plans, including the existing comprehensive plan. That would be our device by which to track compliance. I would also say parenthetically that Joe Weston, the developer in the Pearl that had entered into that original agreement, has since sold a parcel to the Housing Bureau. It's at 14th and Raleigh. The Housing Bureau procured a development partner in the form of Innovative Housing Inc., who is currently in design development on a 12-story building, which will be 100% affordable in that location.
I didn't want to point. I'm more interested in the process. Yeah.
We did take remedial action, however.
My last question, and maybe it's not a question, in your document, it looks to me like you've spent the city spent about $500 million, $500 million on homelessness in the past 10 or so years, with the result of only a slight decline. I guess as a citizen of the city, I'm scared I'm going to come back here in 2 to 10 years and realize we've spent another $500 million and have a result of only a slight decline. That's my concern. So I hope that, I don't know what the answer to that is, but it is a concern of mine.
Well, I think the point in time has identified a nearly static number of 1,800 unsheltered individuals each of the last 3 years. And that is indeed troubling. And frankly, that's the backdrop upon which we are considering this really transformative measure to consolidate homeless services in one place. Because we think we should be getting more bang for the buck, if you will. And we hope to eliminate some of the duplication between multiple contracts with the same vendors. There are many different issues at play. One could argue that had you not invested that money, the problem would be manifold and much worse than it is now. And I'm willing to engage in that debate. But I don't think anybody's satisfied with the current outcome.
Greg. Thank you. I'm looking at page 11 of 25 of this City Budget Office's analysis, and I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying here. The council put the $5 million of ongoing into the budget for this coming year in the full budget monitoring. So we're already $5 million above what we were last year. And then you're recommending another $3.685 million in one-time money in your budget.
Correct.
And your budget is a balanced budget, so there isn't another bucket of something that's sitting out there with $10 million sitting in it. If we wanted to invest another $10 million, we would have to cut somewhere else. Change your recommendations to find it somewhere else.
That's correct. Based on the forecast from Yeah, based on the forecast update in March, there will
okay.
be additional.
Okay, so there may be some additional one-time monies, which we're all hoping for.
There was $10 million total, but $5 million ongoing and $5 million of one-time.
Right. So that's already in the budget, and I really appreciate the middle paragraph here about the investment may not be enough to achieve the goals, and that the council has to weigh this challenge with the other challenges that we're faced with, $15 an hour for contract workers, parks workers, et cetera. So thank you. So that's helpful to know that your recommendations are balanced. Then secondly, the $14.4 million under the new housing investment, that's borrowing against the expected income from the Airbnb taxes. Is that correct? So I just want council to affirm that this is a decision that we're making, that yes, borrowing against that money so that we can get the housing now when it's most acute is a wise strategy. It is an active decision that the council is making. It's part of the budget. That we are choosing to borrow against it, and that would then mean that we would have to pay interest on it, which rather than keeping that money and spending it on a year-by-year basis. So,
right. And that's based, of course, on an assumption that the cost of funds for our bonding is lower than the rate of appreciation of housing costs.
Correct, right. So I support that decision. I just wanted to make sure that we're all aware, because you had a term in your speech that made me smile, because it was securitization of... I forget what it was. It was a beautiful term of art. And then my final point of clarification, it says other program realignment, and you're taking 1.575 out of general fund and into one time. And so that's probably so that we balance the budget and don't have to make another 1.5 million of ongoing cuts. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was actually a proposal that was put forward by the Housing Bureau, and it's related to Multnomah County programs that have been funded by the city for a number of years. So it was part of their proposal when they were provided with $5 million in ongoing and $5 million in one time. They decided to move some ongoing county funding to one-time county funding and propose other ongoing funding streams.
So we worked hard under the Mayor Adams administration to move the so-called shadow budget, the one-times, into the ongoing, including when Commissioner Fish and I put the $7 million for housing into the ongoing budget, handing Mayor Hills a nice challenge in your first year in office. Is this a step going back in the wrong direction? And is this 1.5 going to really, is it really ongoing or is it not really ongoing?
I think that's a really important question, and I think that that's part of the larger conversation around the transition to the new lead agency and the joint office. So there are a number of funds that we're proposing putting towards the joint office in 16-17 that are one time, and I think that there's going to have to be a very clear conversation about what of those funds is actually one time and what is with the intention of continuing for more than 1 year.
And it might be something that in this challenging budget we pretend it's one time and then have a commitment. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I would not pretend, but at least acknowledge.
Acknowledge is a better word, thank you, Mayor. That we're going to try to make things work as well as we can for as many different interests as possible. And sometimes that does mean, yes, we'll fund it one time and we're going to look for a way or maybe even do a budget note or something. So I just wanted to make that piece clear as well, because that's another 1.575 that maybe in the future will need to come out of the ongoing.
I just think this might be an opportunity, Commissioner Fritz is talking about, you've got a balanced budget. I think it might be important every time we have a budget session, or at least every day, to remark that the way you have balanced the budget given current forecasts is in part by making cuts. You propose eliminating all the police officers in the schools. You propose significant cuts in parks programs. That's the context in which we're operating.
Yeah, just to clarify, we aren't proposing to eliminate the school officers. We're proposing to shift the costs to the school district and keep the officers.
But just to clarify, the school district has not agreed to that, right?
Okay, so other quick comments, Dante, before and Frida, and then we'll give the commissioner in charge a chance to wrap up. So,
thank you. Just to echo Commissioner Fish, too, kudos to the Bureau in really identifying what the issues are, and in terms of racial and social equity, certainly who is impacted by by this emergency crisis, as well as really disaggregating this work. I know Matthew and others have worked really hard to be data-driven in this regard. In terms of your realignment slash cut offers, regarding monies that would address audit testing for discrimination, as well as you've identified sort of a number of homes in the county that are headed by those who don't speak English as a first language. How do you plan on continuing to do audit regarding discrimination in housing if we're trying to be preventative and folks maybe are not allowed into housing because of what they look like or how they speak? Can you ensure us that audit testing will continue to happen, and how will you realign to provide the resources for those non-English speaking families?
Yes, I think because of the Supreme Court decision last summer, the Texas case that had found that there was a disparate impact by locating low-income housing tax credit projects in low-income census tracts, and that discrimination need not be overt, but even unintentional discrimination that has a disparate impact on people of color is equally bad and equally offensive under the law. So I think you're going to see a whole new level of interest, focus, and energy around fair housing. Kim McCarty is working on the fair housing plan for Multnomah County. It includes the entire city of Portland. And one thing that we've been working on, we operate a database called ServicePoint. ServicePoint is a platform by which the inputs of all the service providers are collected. And we actually do this for Lane County and other jurisdictions in the state. And we have a contract now with the Community Alliance of Tenants to start uploading their client information as it relates to mass evictions so that we can do cross-tabulations of data so that we can determine if a person of color has been evicted upon notification to CAT, the Community Alliance of Tenants, have they been evicted before? Is this a continuation problem? Are they on a waiting list with Home Forward? And we can start to cross-tabulate that data in a much more robust manner. So I'm pretty confident that we're able to get there. We're also contracting more with folks like the Urban League and other vendors who are culturally specific vendors so that we're able to reach that population with our subcontractor partners. The rental rehab program in East Portland, the EPAP recommendation, is directly aimed at helping preserve housing affordability for communities of color. Well, I think the services are, you know, we procure services through vendors, nonprofit partners, and oftentimes we have a culturally specific expectation. The fall bump, the council will remember, we funded Home Forward to the tune of $445,000 to help enhance voucher utilization. And of that money, navigators are being hired by Home Forward who have non-English language proficiency to help tenants who are immigrants negotiate with landlords on their vouchers. So I think we're helping to bridge that gap. I'm not sure that it's perfect yet, but I think we're making progress.
First of all, I do want to thank the Housing Bureau for its efforts to connect with East Portland Action Plan. As co-chair of housing, we love Michelle being there. She really makes a nice conduit. We're discussing those issues in East Portland, and she's able to relay them back to the Bureau and vice versa. And we really appreciate that. In the past, there actually Housing Bureau had not given an equitable share to East Portland, where we have the predominance, where low income has been concentrated due to gentrification and people of color. And this year, this budget, your budget definitely shows the effort. I want to, on the housing rehabilitation, our offer at East Portland Action Plan is still to have some of our members work with the creation of that. We know the area well, and we would like to really work with that different program to help rehab. Our main goal this year is rehabbing those inferior housing in East Portland. As to the homeownership, home repair retention that CBO did not recommend, I understand about balancing budget. Our school district has to do it all the time. That was made, came out, our request on that was because input from the community. We have a lot of seniors who are fixed income, taxes are going up, they can't afford the repairs. And we heard a definite cry for a need for homeowners to have some ability to stay in their home. This is a retention issue that we're talking about. We saw a big need in East Portland because our senior population, when you talk about the ones that are 30% and under, there's a large portion of senior population that are in that area. But anyway, I do appreciate, we do appreciate that efforts in making it more equitable in East Portland. And I do want to still stress on the homeowner retention. May not be able to give as much, but maybe some toward helping some of those seniors stay in their homes, which will mean one less potentially homeless person. And as regard to the IZ, this has been one of my issues, is distributing affordability throughout the city. As a school board member for 25 years, I've seen the change in our population due to the concentration of low income in East Portland, especially in David Douglas. And I've always felt, as part of getting involved in the housing issue, was that the need to distribute it so the schools can do even a better job than what we're doing, because when you concentrate it, a lot of your funds are going to help students that need extra services instead of, you know, giving more to all. So the more we can do about distributing that throughout the city, it makes for more livable communities. It's better for the lower income because they have access to the amenities they don't have in East Portland right now, and they're close, can be closer to their jobs. Thank you.
Very much. Let me give the commissioner in charge a chance for the last word in this section, and then we'll
Okay. Well, thanks, Mayor, and thanks to Kurt and the rest of the Housing Bureau for presenting a very robust and accountable budget, and that is good, and I appreciate the work of the budget office, too, to improve the recommendations. And I definitely want to thank our Portland Housing Advisory Commission members, particularly the two that are here right now, Sarah Zahn and Dyke Dame, for your service on the Portland Housing Advisory Commission, but really more to the point for your service going down to Salem to help lift the ban on inclusionary housing. Your presence down there literally blew the lid off the Capitol and really altered a debate who had been quite predictable in the past as to who lines up on what side, and it has been a very predictable debate in Salem. But your presence down there, developers coming down to support lifting the ban on inclusionary housing, made all the difference, and that's why we got bipartisan results, and it'll be signed into law this Friday. So I just want to thank you for your continued service.
Thank you. You're here. So thank you all. We're going to move on to our next item. Just a quick question for Jessica and Jay-Marie and Andrew, and that is, as we're flagging these requests to bureaus for follow-up written information, are you tracking that? And obviously, it should go to all five of us or six of us, not just...
So what we do process-wise is all the questions that come up through the session, we capture... we send back out to the Bureau and then have them send the information back and then distribute it out to Council.
And in addition to us electeds, are you getting that back to
the entire budget
as well?
Committee, okay, including the citizen advisors. Right. And we also post it on our website so anyone can see it.
Thank you very much. We'll take a two-minute break and then do PDC.
Thank you.
Delay is dangerous, so are breaks. So we're damned if we do, damned if we don't. But anyway, we're ready to get going again. So, all right. Well, without fanfare or preface, we're going to just turn it right over to you, Patrick, and your team to give us your presentation, and then we'll hear from CBO, and then we'll discuss as laid out in our agenda here. So have at it, please. Good morning.
Mr. Mayor, Commissioners, Tom Kelly, PDC Chair. I guess you have to put up with me first before Patrick. PDC is pleased to participate in today's work session on the fiscal year 2016-17 requested budget. I'm joined today by Executive Director Patrick Quinton, Deputy Director Kimberly Branham, and Budget Officer Wizard Tony Barnes. The budget before you was created between November and January is informed by PDC's strategic plan and agency work plan, which the board received at its annual retreat in December. All projects reviewed using guidelines by city policies, including the Portland plan and the draft 2035 comp plan. The budget was reviewed by PDC's two budget advisory groups, the Central City Budget Advisory Group and the Neighborhood Economic Development Leadership Budget Subcommittee, as well as PDC's board members on January 27th. Letters from the advisory groups are included in the requested budget document. Staff, stakeholders, and PDC board members were aligned on key urban renewal area project budget decisions, which include complete acquisition of the U.S. Postal Service site in River District, construction of the Convention Center Hotel parking garage, implementation of the Lentz Town Center projects, implementation of the Halsey Wilder investment strategy, and the construction of Bond Avenue in North McAdam. Included in the budget and to be detailed in Patrick's overview are PDC's recommended general fund 5% cuts, as well as five decision packages that would add $1.1 million in either one-time or ongoing funding to the city-wide economic development priorities that align with PDC's strategic plan, including the Powell Division Local Action Plan and Small Business Increase Project and the B Corp program. As we move closer to the sunset of the active urban renewal areas and recognize the limitations of TIF to move forward critical components of the PDC strategic plan, we will begin implementing the work of PDC's Financial Sustainability Committee next year. The staff has been working on that, and we are going to see the outcomes of that first part of May. And, of course, we'll be reporting back to you about that plan. I'll turn it over to Patrick.
Thank you, Chair Kelly, and you won't have to put up with me for very long. Truly, won't put me for very long. I'm going to turn it over to Kimberly. Obviously, this is my last work session with all of you, so partly wanted just to thank all of you for the opportunity to work on budgets over many years. It's even though a lot of people don't like the budget process, I've always appreciated the scrutiny, but also the conversation, the priority setting. So I might be odd in saying I'm going to miss this process, but. I guess I just wanted to highlight once again, this is really focuses on our general fund ask. We have a very short period of time today. We come back again to you when you sit as our budget committee and we go through the full PDC budget, and we can get into all sorts of conversations around URA specific projects and how we spend our TIF. I think we really do want to focus on both the cuts that we put out, but also the ad requests. And Kimberly has been closest to that, and we'll walk through that. We do have on our You guys have our PowerPoint. So we do have on there on our presentation both our requested budget and our resources and expenditures. Just as a reminder, you can see that the bulk of our budget really is tax increment. So general fund represents a very small piece of this. It resides within on the second page, this intergovernmental revenues line of part of that $10 million is our general fund request. So much of this is TIF. And we do have, we continue to sit on significant TIF balances, cash really from debt proceeds that hasn't been spent. When we get to the city council sitting as our full budget committee, we can talk through the significant expenditures that we expect in the coming fiscal year, but that's all relates to TIF. And so you can see that on the next slide, the significant amount of property redevelopment, in particular, the dollars that we expect to go out in the coming year. And while we've been saying that annually for a while, I do think we are finally at a stage where between the post office, Centennial Mills, the Convention Center Hotel, the priorities that the chair mentioned, we will see a significant outflow of dollars in 16-17, as well as the increased housing expenditures. So it could be a record year for PDC in terms of dollars going out the door. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kimberly. She's going to walk. There's a set-aside slide next. She's been close to that, working closely with the Housing Bureau on that, and then she'll walk through each of the general fund items. Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning. So the next slide, and we did share an updated PowerPoint presentation, so I want to make sure that you're following along on the presentation that Tony just shared. So the update to the TIF lift, the affordable housing set aside, you see a summary of that right now, and that was put in effect to increase the set aside from 30% to 45% for all of the active urban renewal areas. So as a reminder, downtown waterfront, South Park blocks, and the Oregon Convention Center are closed districts, and so we maintain the same level of investment in affordable housing that we did prior to the decision to increase the set aside. The Central East Side, Lentz, Interstate, Gateway, North McAdam, and River District all saw some levels of increase. With the Central East Side, the decision to increase the set-aside came when we amended and extended the Central East Side District, so that went from 18% to 30% of the new resources. Within Lentz, there was a modest increase. The most significant increase has occurred within the Interstate Urban Renewal Area, where we are now at 30% of the resources go to PDC and 70% go to the Housing Bureau. And so we've been working closely with the Housing Bureau to think about how we can really have a comprehensive approach in that district and what our closeout strategy will be. Within Gateway, we also increased the resources by a modest $2 million, taking resources from the out years and bringing them into the budget and five-year forecast. North McAdam, we are now at 46%. We had been closer to 35. And then within the River District, there's an increase of $20 million, which at least $13 million of which will go into acquisition and securing affordable housing at the U.S. Post Office. So that's some context in terms of PDC's overall TIF picture. The next slide gives you an overview of our 16-17 general fund request. And I want to focus briefly just on our ongoing programs as a reminder. So we have two primary and complementary bodies of work. The first is the neighborhood economic development strategy and the work that we do to support our neighborhood and Main Street network. So we support 8 community-based organizations, primarily in East Portland and North and Northeast Portland, to deliver on their district plans, city general funds. And those go to support full-time staff people as well as a Vista volunteer and district and marketing. We also work closely with Venture Portland, who supports 37 of the volunteer-run business district associations. They're a close partner of ours. We have the Small Business Micro and Technical Assistance Program, where we support about 600 businesses annually. Those are primarily focused on serving business owners of color, business owners that have low incomes, and English language learners. We also have an adult and youth workforce program that serves about 1,000 people annually through our technical assistance providers, our local workforce development providers. And so that body of work represents 65% of our general fund of our annual general fund resources. The other 35% goes to support traded sector economic development activities, and that's primarily individual business development for our cluster industries, so athletic and outdoor, green cities, products and services, metal and machinery, manufacturing, and technology and digital media. So we do work to support those businesses individually to help them grow. We also do industry-wide initiatives to increase diversity, for example, and efficiency within businesses. Within our entrepreneurship body of work, this has become an increasing focus of ours. We look at this exclusively or really primarily focused on inclusive entrepreneurship. So we just launched an inclusive startup fund, which will help support early stage businesses to grow, and those are focused on diverse founders. And so that's the context, and those are our primary programs that we've used to support the general fund resources. And while they are a small part, they are really precious dollars, and we leverage them as much as possible. So we did put forward five decision packages to meet the $268,000 cut packages, and then another $1.13 million. And I know you've been briefed on these, so I will go through them at a high level. On the next slide, page five, you'll see that the within the 5% reduction packages, we've ordered these. So these are from our top priority on down. So our first priority is a small and micro business technical assistance. Without this buyback, we will need to reduce one of our technical assistance providers. The CBO actually recommended that we take this cut instead of from technical assistance, from our small business technical assistance, from our workforce development line item, because that's a more sizable line item. And so we would consider that, or we would look to see where we could potentially hold the small business technical assistance program harmless, but we feel like that's our highest priority package. Small business working capital, we would take a cut here. We think we can absorb that for 1 year. It's a revolving fund, and so we believe that we could for 1 year not infuse additional capital. Southeast Works and VOES are both programs that we support, but given that the other projects have been competitively, we secured them competitively, our budget advisory committees recommended that these be on the reduction packages, and then Greater Portland Inc. is an important partner, but again, given the 5% reduction packages, we felt like this was something that we could put forward.
How much do we fund Southeast Works through other programs in PDC?
I would need to look at it. It's about $200,000.
This isn't getting all of their support. And then the other issue is for council that where we put a special appropriation to have safe harbor in a bureau or PDC in this case, we should have a policy about that doesn't count towards its 5% cuts, mm-hmm. and it doesn't get cut as in its entirety to mm-hmm. meet the 5% cut in future years.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner, we support Southeast Works about $280,000.
Question, a comment. First, a comment, Mayor. Under the budget guidance this year, we did not restrict anybody from coming in and offering ad packages. And in a year in which we asked for 5% cut packages, we've received just shy of $100 million of ad packages. And I think we've learned something from that. And while you won't be issuing the next budget guidance, I intend to work with my colleagues to actually put a hard cap on that. I think that there should be, in fairness, where we're asking for proposed cuts, we're sending kind of a mixed message to the public. And no bureau has violated the rules in putting ad packages. But I think we would be well served to consider either a hard cap or a guideline subject to an exception, and an exception in a year in which 1 year we make the exception for transportation funding, another year for housing or whatever. But it does seem anomalous that we have almost $100 million of new ads we're weighing. And I think part of the challenge we have is that we're now being asked to weigh a cut with an ad package, which wasn't quite what the exercise. I mean, for example, I can't possibly support cutting VOES to fund B Corps. And so I will support, Mayor, I don't care where VOES shows up. quite frankly. I, if you want to put it in your budget, special appropriate, if you want to put it with utilities and general fund money, we'll be honored to administer it. But with general fund money. But I don't care. We're not. This council is not going to cut this. And I appreciate that you have to show cuts. We're not going to cut votes. If anything, we'll add to it. And it was actually a big lift to get it to ongoing funding. So this is a twofer. We're taking it out of ongoing and we're cutting it. But my question about your proposed budget is the following. One of your 5% cuts is small business working capital. And that one to me requires a little more drilling down, because what we hear consistently is there's a problem in the small business community getting access to that short-term capital. And it's harder and harder. Banks' underwriting standards are changing. It's more difficult. A startup business has trouble getting that working capital. Would you, as part of the follow-up, give us a little more information about all the programs that you have around small business working capital? For example, we cut some of those programs in North Northeast to fund housing. So we've been adding, subtracting, shifting. I think to evaluate this cut, this proposed cut, it'd be helpful to know what's the total package from all sources of that small business working capital. And then I would appreciate some commentary about what is, in a perfect world, the right size of that. Because again, we hear consistently from businesses that that's very important to them. And one thing I think the data tells us is that a ton of people are applying and securing business licenses and chasing a dream in a smaller enterprise. I'd hate to cut off a program for which there isn't a better option in the private marketplace. So could we see a slightly bigger lens about what your programs are and how this would impact?
And before we get too deep into discussion, I do want to give Josh and Katie a chance to respond. So are you, I didn't want to cut you off if you weren't done, Kimberly. Okay. All right. So Josh, Katie, please.
All right. Thank you, Mayor. I don't think we have a whole lot to add. I will just say that we recommended two fund votes, not take that cut. And as part of that recommendation, we sort of postulated that maybe PDC isn't the right place for it. Just given sort of what their dynamics are and what they're trying to do. But we did recommend not taking that cut, and we also recommended funding the one-time funding for the Old Town Chinatown action plan that the city has committed to. This would be the second year of three to help facilitate that community as part of the city. I'm happy to talk about any of the other recommendations or any of the other ad packages or cuts that you see here, and what sort of our perspective on those, but I don't want to take up, in the interest of time, I don't want to take up any more as we're already sort of pushing the limits of the schedule.
And Mayor, can I just want to just clarify, we have stated consistently, I think since we submitted this and in briefings, our first choice is to restore cuts, and then the ad package is second. So we're not in any way advocating for ad packages, and saying we're fine with cuts. Right. So if there is an opportunity to restore the cuts, that would be our first choice.
That's a consequence of the process, not your recommendation. I get it. Yeah.
Okay. Commissioner Hall.
Yeah. So I had a question about the $400,000 ad package for the PAL Division Bus Rapid Transit. I guess I thought that project had sort of hit a bump on the road in as much as it doesn't look like it's going to be faster than the current bus service. So isn't it premature to be hiring workforce managers, navigators, and things like that?
So when we submitted the package, there was a different timeline, and I think certainly we would accept that probably at this point it would be wise to wait until we have clarity on the project. There is still, TriMet is still moving forward with a proposed bus rapid transit line. That's our understanding, and so we would probably look to come back to City Council sometime next year when we have additional clarity. I think the locally preferred alternative will be coming to you sometime late this summer, early fall, and we would love to, at that point, be able to have a conversation about how we fund the community development components that we think are complementary, but yes, the timeline has moved back.
Just to clarify, TriMet is now thinking about doing a phased project that would start with BRT on Division from 82nd to East. And the community has made it very clear that people in East Portland don't want a BRT project unless there are things in place that will prevent it from simply being a vehicle for gentrification. So I think that unless we are prepared to say that we want to pull the plug entirely on the whole project in any form, having continued investment in local action plan type activities is really important, because we don't want to wind up with a project that the community doesn't want.
Well, this is a gnarly one, and I want to let them off the hook a bit, because I was pushing this expenditure on PDC on the assumption that the project was moving forward aggressively. But it gets gnarlier than that, because if it's only the outer portion of the corridor, there's not as much value. It doesn't drive an urban renewal district as well. So it's a thicket, and we all need to spend some time cutting our way around in it and see if we can figure out a way forward. But the discussion is apt, which is if the project is not viable in some form, then forming a UR doesn't make any sense. I get that, but that's still an if, and none of us wants that to be the answer, I don't think. But we got to be realistic about if and when both before we make this budget decision. Other questions, comments, please, Don.
I just wanted to comment on Commissioner Fish's observation. You're exactly right. Small businesses are struggling with banks, loans. The credit underwriting and so forth. I'm giving a talk on this in May. So the alternative to this is there are about 38 websites now where a small business can go and get a loan. Sometimes the conditions are a bit difficult. Goldman Sachs thinks this is the next bank disruptor, and $18 billion in small business loans by the end of 2017. So there are some alternatives. I'm not sure it's as good as you all offer, and sometimes it's pretty difficult. The terms are pretty difficult, but there are some alternatives to the bank loans.
Just to add to that, our feeling right now, and it's, you know, we continue to learn from our work, is that businesses that work, the priority businesses we work with, need technical assistance. They need kind of a package of what, you know, mentorship assistance, whatnot, in addition to financing. So financing alone is never the solution for the businesses we work with, and so we can't do one without the other. So it has to be viewed in that context. If we don't have the assistance to provide them, then we can have as much loan money as you guys can afford, and we still wouldn't either get it out the door or do an effective job with it. It really needs to be paired with sophisticated technical assistance.
Okay, other questions, concerns, Dante?
Yeah, thank you. I guess I would just echo Commissioner Fish and the other comments regarding the cut package request. So moving to the ad package, I'm just curious, because I had the same concern about B Corps versus the cuts. What do you see as the benefit to being a B Corp besides them being able to market their business? And what's the typical size and or demographics of who in this city are B Corps?
Situated to answer that question.
You know, I think first of all, characterizing B Corps as a marketing program is like off the mark. The purpose of B Corporation is to really provide a certification for companies that are giving back to the community, are paying their employees well. The community of B Corporations in our city have values that, for instance, supported the minimum wage increases. You see New Seasons, you see many of the larger B Corporations supporting that. At the same time, I just want to say that, you know, the vast majority of B Corps, I don't have the statistics, but just in my experience, the vast majority in Portland are smaller companies. There's maybe a dozen of the larger ones, but everyone else is small companies, and they're really implementing B Corp in order to be a better place to work, in order to give back to the community. I think that the investment is going to be one that results in a flowering of our business community, of our progressive business community. It's going to result in leveraging dollars in philanthropy and giving back to the community that we otherwise might not see.
I guess my question slash comment would be, are we incentivizing folks? Are we trying to pay folks to do what they are doing anyway because they think it's the right thing to do? Or are they doing this in order to become certified? I mean, what's the, on balance, how's the process?
I think many of the companies that have become B Corporations have been doing a lot of what I'm talking about already. However, there's many companies out there that this B Corp movement will, they'll be able to learn about these values and implement those values into their companies, and I think therefore be a lot more viable members of the community, the business community, as well as the community in general. At least when we made the decision, my company, we understand there's some value from a marketing perspective, but it was more about the employees, more about expressing our values as a business. And the fact that we can be certified is that we can then really talk about it more, because otherwise, if you don't have something to back you up, that you're doing what you say you're doing, it's pretty incredible. We just went through a B Corp recertification, and it is a very challenging and deep process that took a lot of effort on our part. It's not a surface kind of look at a company, and it has to do with things like how we pay our people. There's actually a ratio between the top pay in the organization and the lowest pay, and my company scored the best score on that, which I like to say is good for my employees, not good for me. So there's a lot of measurements that I think are in the B Corporation world that are very Portland-like and speak to our values.
And please understand, I'm not trying to minimize the value that it brings to the employees and the community when a company is certified in or doing that work. I guess just on balance as it relates to, are we funding those to a significant degree in their budget or, work systems? How are we evaluating and balancing benefits to either side of that?
I would fund both before B Corp too. I mean, just to be really clear.
When you say small business, what size in revenue are you talking? Because I worked for a small business that was doing $6 million in revenue, and most people don't think of those as small businesses, but I know our category 14 million was a small business. So what size is this program? When you say there's a lot of small business, are we talking under a million, under two, under five?
I can't really answer that with any authority, and it's only what I see when I ever go to a B Corporation meeting, and I think the list of companies that are over $10 million in revenues is pretty short, and everyone else would be less than that, and I think there's a whole lot of companies that are less than a million. Do you have those stats?
No, I mean, just Portland, generally speaking, it's like 90-plus percent of the companies in Portland have fewer than 20 employees. So everything we do from economic development perspective, with a few exceptions, is working with small businesses, and by like even the federal definition, it's very small businesses. So it would be, so that's the focus of our B Corp or Benefit Corporation effort, is to bring it to the businesses we work with regularly, which are almost universally under 20 employees. That's just who you work with in Portland. We just don't have that many companies that are bigger than that.
You do have to be careful, because professional services with 20 employees can do a $5 million. That experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also in regard to your small business lending, just a comment, having been a small business owner for like 16 years and having an MBA, so I understand what's needed to run a business. And it's unfortunate. I'm sure we're getting a lot of people saying we don't get a loan, we can't access a loan. But often most of them aren't well-equipped even to be asking for the loan. They don't understand their business. And this is from talking with people. I always said that one of the things I always wanted to volunteer with some of the nonprofits was teaching people what payroll laws, wage and hour laws were for especially these minority companies, because they are clueless on what it the legalities of running a business. So the fact that they can't say that can access it, often you have to drill down a lot deeper. But another question I have on your Southeast Worth Youth, I noticed it's for helping GEDs, et cetera. Are you coordinating with schools in the area? I know at David Douglas, our alternative program works with students. Not all of them go for diplomas. Some of them go for GEDs. So are you working together with them? Because I see a synergy there.
You know, Southeast Works primarily focuses this program on disconnected youth, so youth that are no longer connected. But I know that they have deep relationships in the community, and so I'm sure that there are some synergies there. But we can follow up with that particular program.
I think it's good because if we can pull them back into the school, which we try to with our alternative programs in different ways, it's better for the community, better for the student, because they get a slightly better education if they're in the school environment. Thank you.
Response is needed. If not, Tom, thank you very much. Patrick, Kimberly, thank you very much. Appreciate Tony. Thank you all. We'll move on. Patrick, your last budget discussion was mercifully brief. So. Appreciate that impressive list of projects that Patrick is working on in his remaining time in this role. Coming out in a blaze of glory. Thank you very much. All right, we're going to move on to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I see Susan is here and others on her team, so come on up.
Thanks, Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Development of Planning and Sustainability. And with me are Michael Armstrong, Joe Zunder, and our honorary member, Linda Nettikoden, who representing our Budget Advisory Committee. I'm going to spend 6 or 7 minutes giving you an overview, and then we can have Linda say a few words and get on to your questions. For the past few years, BPS has completed some very large and landmark plans, the Portland Plan, the Climate Action Plan, soon the new Comprehensive Plan, and later this year the new Central City Plan. So we've been up in the policy world for